I start with the customary one of the region. Hi, folks. Yeah. Last night, we had the old turkey. And some are good enough to say that a few cranberries came with it. It was a time of reminiscence. It was, as we remember, the story of how we took our first steps toward freedom from what had been a fatal obsession. It concerned itself with recovery. It seems altogether fitting tonight that we pursue this account of our quest for freedom as a society. What this freedom means...
Go ahead. Don't mind me.
Is this getting too hot or too cold?
Too windy.
There. I wish I could say that the yarns of yesterday and of yesteryear could be the theme of this meeting. But I think we have some serious business. And I think my assigned topic is where do we stand today? And without any presumption of prophecy, where might we go tomorrow? Or where might we not? Someone only last week called my attention to the fact that 8 of the 12 steps have directly to do with this process of taking inventory. This matter of self-survey, or else were directly related to that vital and beneficial process. In a fragmentary way, I've taken an inventory of AA. In the taking of inventory, when we look on the positive side and upon the blessings of God that has made that possible, is a pleasing process. The taking of inventory, if it is a long one, can be a tedious process. So, if any go to sleep, never mind, it'll be all right. The taking of inventory at depth is, of course, a painful process. But this is the liberating process. This is mounting the stair to freedom. So we're going to make a stab at it. Nothing could be more like bringing coals to Newcastle than for me in this tradition-conscious area to start a run-through of the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Out here you have a certain formalism which in its mantram repetition of reading the 12 steps and the 12 traditions in each meeting is magnificent. And it spreads ever eastward. and I hope the custom will be general. But it occurred to me as I thought about tonight's subject, realizing that I hadn't had an original idea in at least 10 years, if ever, that traditions really fall into some classifications. And the first classification has to do with those ideas and attitudes which are protective. They are the lead us not into temptation aspect of tradition. And then we have a purpose clause in which we say our sole purpose is sobriety, but as we know, at the latter end of the 12 steps, we pledge ourselves to try to practice these principles in all our affairs. So actually, we only achieve freedom from obsession by some practice of the 12 steps, and we only achieve a greater liberation, moving toward greatness of spirit of action, by the sustained practice of it. So we have a purpose, and this is it. Then we have in the 12 steps a specific charter of liberty. And this we define when we say that the conscience of this society, when rightly informed, and when moved by God, is our sole authority. This was a long-doubted proposition, but it's one that has worked, and we think it's right. So that, indeed, is a broad expanse of liberty. Freedom under God, is it not? This does, however, imply trust not in God, but in each other, and in a class of people we call trusted servants. An aspect of tradition, too, we sometimes forget, and one on which I shall venture to dwell a little bit longer. Then we have another vital aspect of our charter for liberty. That has to do with membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. Few societies or governments there must be when a person can be a member, a citizen in full standing the moment he says so. He has to meet conditions. Here there are no conditions. We believe that we should have no second-class members. We believe that we should not enforce any obedience. A vast charter of liberty. Then, one of the traditions deals with this question of our relation to the world around us. It says that our relation there should be characterized by attraction rather than promotion. Then there is the tradition of anonymity, which has a protective aspect, first against stigma and insurance to the newcomer. Then it has an aspect of protection for the movement against a few of us who would like to pursue fame and fortune in public. And then it has a far deeper spiritual effect or characteristic. It has to do with the spiritual foundation on which the whole tradition rests, and indeed on which the common welfare, tradition one, depends for freedom under God. And that we shall explore a bit. Now, some say, naturally enough, that we in this century live in a most unfortunate time. A time when that old coin marked pride with its aspirations to power and domination and self-justification, marked on the other side with fear, which has inevitably generated angers the like of which you've never seen. This coin is in far greater circulation in the world today than mankind has ever seen it. This is not good. This is not fortunate in itself. But let us never say that we are unfortunate because we have appeared in this generation. Because this coin has circulated more freely among us than ever in the citizens of the world around us. And this coin and its pursuit has led us in a wrong and ignorant pursuit of liberty. We have sought the liberty to become wealthy beyond our right. We have sought security complete. We have sought prestige. We have sought fame. We have sought power. We have sought to be justified. And when we have been frustrated in these areas, more than almost any other people, when these false freedoms were not granted, we have turned upon people in anger and blame and recrimination and attack. And quite as often, we have turned upon ourselves in excessive guilt and blame and attack. And then we have found John Barleycorn to just exaggerate and help things along, to help us to dream greater dreams of power, greater dreams of distinction. to make us feel more comfortable in any dependency that we might have, to wash away the guilt, even to increase our anger and scheme to the downfall of our enemies. Yes, we know the currency of this false coin with which we sought to purchase freedom. Let us not blame ourselves too much. A lot of this was due to ignorance. A lot of it was due to compulsions of which we knew not. But even then, we had a certain responsibility. So we were carried down into the pit, toward which the whole world is moving. And this, for us, proved to be, as we constantly hope it will be for the whole world, not the pit of oblivion, but the pit of opportunity. And then came a courier with good news, a message of liberation, and we are freed from the alcohol obsession. Only the first step, and this one, not with just an assist from God, we are literally levitated out of this pit into sobriety as a gift and as a chance for a new beginning. But at this point, this being achieved, our power of choice to a degree restored, what's the next step? Well, it's increasing worthiness. And it always has to begin with this self-survey. Where do we stand on fear in all its malign ramifications? And where do we stand on pride and self-justification in its even more subtle and powerful strength? Where do we stand? And what can we do? And how shall we set from day to day, as individuals and as a society? Surely we can't patronize the world around us. Those folks out there are clearly on a dry bender too. We well understand. We have been the more fortunate because our suffering has brought us to a pass where we can no longer pass the buck and say, if only they would behave this way or that way, then we would be happy and secure and wealthy and wise. No, fortunately, our suffering has forced us into a position where the responsibility is on each and every one of us. And there is a collective responsibility on the whole of us. This is a great good fortune. And let us hope that in our small way, without going in for any world saving, the example of this society may be helpful for those on dry benders around us. Yes, for all of us, it's a quest for evermore freedom under God. An increased freedom of choice. There are some who say that the world was so constructed that there was never any freedom of choice, that all is cause and effect, and that one thing happening causes another to happen, and that there is a sort of a fatal predestination about which we can do nothing. We are not such determinists as that. For whatever the partial merit of that argument, we know that our freedom of choice under God can and will increase if we as individuals in this society become willing to be worthy and to meet certain conditions. So now we come to this all-important matter of self-survival. We come to this all-important matter of making a decision every day. Each and all of us, whether it will be a decision that will move us toward destruction, whether it will be a decision that will temporarily sustain us in comfort and mediocrity, or whether as a society, regardless of slips and slides, can consistently pursue the ideal of greatness and spirit and action. These are the choices that face the world around us. These are the choices which, praise God, are increasingly ours. Now what, as a society, are the first things that we need to look at to be sure that our foot is on that path of progress? I might add, before we take up specific topics, that this society, for all of the frailty of us individuals in it, and the overhang from yesterday is very grievous indeed, yet collectively, as well as individually, we have astounding advantages over other societies and governments. I didn't say, please remember, that we had virtues which were superior. I am merely trying to say that we have here inherent advantages. To begin with, every society that I know of has to have some kind of human authority in it, and ours does not. It doesn't have to be governed in any ordinary sense. Why? Because John Barleycorn is just this far from the elbow of everybody, and he is saying, obey or I will kill. And we watch him kill. But we don't have to have a human killer. And when we obey because we must, and we obey because we want to, we ought to. That's the progression. So we don't have to be troubled with the government. We don't have to be troubled with the management of great property. We don't have to be troubled with the solicitation of a lot of money. We don't even have to be troubled, really, with this problem which faces all societies of fission and division and schism. Paradoxically, very strangely, we can invite these very things. Supposing that a drunk sits in out there and he's looking us over and, gee, says, I don't like this crowd. Well, from what I've read, they're kind of God-bitten. I suspect the management, that Wall Street racketeer standing up there, I think I can do better elsewhere. Well, we don't have to collar him and save him. We hope to God he does better elsewhere. But if he don't, he probably is coming back. We are division-proof because we can safely invite division. We don't, like this country once did, have to fight a civil war to stay united. We fight lots of civil wars, to be sure, but not to be united. What can we do? A fellow says, I don't like my group. We say, for heaven's sake, start another one. Now, it is a curious fact about AA that the individual has had practically all the grief there is. His group, or certainly the early groups, had nearly every trouble known to the mind of man. So have areas. And yet never in the whole history of this society has a great issue cut across us to divide us. And lest we be caught unaware, let us ask ourselves what we ought to do if that's threatened. Our first reaction would say, my God, we must hold this thing together. They must not go. But why shouldn't we take the same attitude that we do every day on the smaller scale and say, good friends, we have no pride of membership. We have no property to quarrel about. We have no authority to defend. If you think you can do better under other auspices, by all means, go and try. You can take everything you've got with you and our complete blessing, all except the name Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd kind of like to hang on to that one. And when you arrive where you're going, under new ideas or under new auspices, and you do better, and you grow faster in numbers and in recovery and in maturity and in freedom under God, Alcoholics Anonymous is going to take some lessons from you people. But if it so turns out that your death rate mounts and your discontent mounts, and the old obsession is back in full force, and you haven't any more choices, you'll just be so damn glad to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous that it's nobody's business. So here is the whole world which fears for fission and division. And we have nothing to fear. Because this is an inherent advantage, let me emphasize again, not a virtue. It's a kind of a singular gift of God to us. That the fear of the world outside, in greater part, need not be ours at all. Now, however, there comes this question of prudence. And prudence is a kind of a sound halfway point somewhere between fear and recklessness. The middle road, I think the Greeks used to call it. So a lot of these traditions deal not with fear, they deal with prudence. And prudence means anticipation, and it means those ideas and attitudes that can avoid temptation. Well, what are these specifically? And with respect to them, how are we doing? It's the first time I ever came on a lectern with documents. I don't know how we'll do. You can go, still go to sleep if you want. How are we doing in our relations with each other? Well, we're doing a whole lot better than we used to. Many of the fears of yesteryear are gone. And newcomers seeing these fears no more don't so easily catch the contagion and retort in anger and aggression and gossip, nor do so many as formerly turn into Pharisees who would save the movement from the sinners, notably me. No, there isn't so much of this as there was. Because we are eroding the face of that coin marked fear and pride as it starts, which means we are growing in freedom under God's grace. But believe me, this is an everlasting and eternal job. I sometimes tremble to think of what would be the consequences if this movement as a whole really got mad at something or somebody. As a whole, all of us at once. So let's watch for improvement here. Now let's take up some of our other relations. We have facilities and people at work in relationships that are close but yet not quite of AA. We have clubs. We have drying out places. We have retreats. We have meditation groups. We have breakfast. Well, we like to sniddle out, and there's still a good deal of fear about these places, and therefore a very considerable amount of aggression. But compared with what it used to be, to me it's laughable. Looks to you to be very serious, but it's really very amusing. Forgive me, but I snicker about it. In the old days of the clubs, there were those who said, let us abolish these clubs. They are sinkholes of iniquity. They play cards in there. More females get into trouble than in the back seats of automobiles. Above all, we must be respectable. So said the Pharisees and the fearful of those days. But then it got to be very obvious that by jinks we were going to have clubs. So were these going to be a function of AA or just a function of the folks that really badly needed or wanted clubs? Well, we've since learned, those of us who are comfortably housed and fed and warm, that these lonely people and others who are gregarious in the club sense find something very worthwhile in these clubs, and that no club is so damn bad that it hasn't got a plus sign on it. And anything that we've got in AA, if it's bad enough, just disappears. We don't have to maul it. We don't have to fight about it. We don't have to save the movement from it. You know that John Barleycorn is a very smart operator in this area. We can depend on him. Now we indulge, if I may so say so, in quite a lot of nonsense about some of the nearby operations due to the terrible dearth of hospitalization. A lot of drunks have gone into the business of drying up lately. We can buy nice estates tax-free and house up the drunks and get a doctor on the job, and we're in business. Well, boy, that was once a problem. What would drunks know about this? Would we be careless about medical protection and get hooked for practicing medicine? Would you have to whistle if you stepped off the back porch after dark every night? What would become of thee? Answer was very simple. The bum ones went out of business. The good ones stayed in business. We got over mauling these people, and we only exerted real group opinion upon them to dampen their eagerness to use the name Alcoholics Anonymous publicly to get customers and money. There we stuck a little, and there we should stick, but not angrily, just persistently. Then there come the benign activities of friends around. Retreats are run for AA. And we have some meditation groups. And we have breakfast where people eat and talk about God as they understand. And every once in a while we get a fume and a stint, and we say, well, this should be no part of AA. About that, we're right. But if we begin to say to AA members, you shall not do these things, we are getting into the business of government. We are interfering with the right of assembly that the free world gives everybody. And we can take the breakfast, the retreats, the drying out places, or we can leave them alone. Just one thing we insist upon in the interest of our own security. Please, dear people, don't tag these efforts publicly with the AA name. Other words, wise, God bless you. Assemble as you like. Now we come to a little more ticklish subject. We're going to take one more step out. Lots of people are good enough to say nowadays that our spectacular, though still small, success with drunks has brought fresh hope to the clergy, the medical profession, prison authorities, mental hospitals, states, governments, municipalities, where there was none. Let me tell you a little yarn. In about the year two of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was down with dear old Fitz Mayo, whose delightful, sweet story in that old book was called Our Southern Friend. And Fitz said to me in his inimitable way one day in about year two of AA, he says, Bill, he says, I think we ought to get the government back to this. Says, let's go over to Washington and see the health department. So over to Washington we went. I guess we had 40 members. No, we didn't. We had 20 or 25 members by then. Would have been dry a while. Of course, we wanted to see the head man. And he wasn't available. But we did see a gent that's become a great friend of this society. One of those perceptive people who understood the language of the heart. That's Dr. Lawrence Cole. And whether he's here or whether he isn't, I offer my thanks to him on behalf of all AA. He was then, I think, Assistant Surgeon General of the United States. And we came in and told him the little story of our beginning and of our recovery. And he was impressed. He said, you know, this is the first time I've had any hope whatever of chronic alcoholics. We have pondered and pondered down here in the government what we do about this terrible mounting problem of chronic alcoholism. And the answer has been nothing. That this obsession is so grim that if it weren't for the fact that drinking is a socially accepted thing, everybody would recognize it as hopeless lunacy to be classed with schizophrenia or kleptomania. This is too tough. Now, people who get on dope, we really thought there might be a chance. And we're just spending some money to put up a hospital for narcotic addicts down at Lexington. But drunks up to now, no thanks. Now you give me a ray of hope. And he has held up our hands ever since. That's how tough this thing is. So the interest of the world has been aroused in trying to solve this problem. And we ourselves are the very first to say that this is a problem which has to do with the soul. We think we've got one. Some people don't. It's a problem of ignorance and of the intellect. And some people will consider we drunks are ignorant, may or may not have intellect, although we're apt to think, you know, that our IQ is a little higher. We once run a psychiatric test on a bunch of drunks. Gee, I was in it myself too, and we came out just on par with everyday folks. Well, where I was, I got to get back to documents here. Where was I at? You can't hear? Oh, he was sleeping. We were talking about the relation with outside agencies in the field of alcohol. So here a clergyman in succession from Moses and the cross and world wine from the other great sources. We can learn about them, from them a lot about the soul and its ailments. We can learn a lot from the psychiatrists and the psychologists about the ailments of the emotions. And then there come the ailments of the body, which accompany this. And the body is no doubt deformed, and that is coming increasingly into view right now. Now, how are we going to be related to all of these people who, under the hope that we have given them, are laboring each in their several ways to mitigate this dire illness upon which we have made only the merest scratch? Shall we be loud in condemnation of the medical profession when some new drug comes out that gives us the heebie-jeebies? We ain't mad to the distillers. We don't drink their wares. We don't have to take the pills, even though they're good for other people, do we? So why slug new attempts to mitigate the body ills of people? Let us be wide open. Let us be friendly. Let us take a firm stance when we know where we're talking about, and let us be filled with eager and hopeful expectancy otherwise. I think we can do that. There isn't any danger. Friendliness is not very expensive. Then this illness of the emotions. I think one of life's darkest moments was that day back in very early time of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we just cracked a couple of those nut factories out east. And a couple of the psychiatrists came down there from one of them and to look over their first meeting, our first, one of our meetings. And we had a wonderful AA, that is, he said he was wonderful. And he loved to talk, and he had lots better adjectives than mine. And he had a cynical sense of humor. And he'd been a motion picture magnate quite briefly, I might add. And he was a man of the world. And the motion picture people had had him analyzed. And he'd become very contemptuous of psychiatry and all its work. So here were these friends who were beginning to trust us to come out of bug houses to AA meetings, doctors trained in psychiatry, who now come to the meeting and sit in the back row to see what is going on. And of God is, I'm charitable enough to believe that he didn't know they were there. And if every psychiatry got a lambasting, he really dished it out. Not for 5 minutes, for 35 minutes. Well, I suppose the psychiatrist on the back row said, well, we hope this is not too prevalent, but this is probably a case of considerable maladjustment. So they were at once capable of a charity for them that we never have been of them. And back of me in our board of trustees sits a psychiatrist who has held up the hands of this movement from its beginning, when it was costly, and took great courage, great understanding, and great humility to do so. He got me to read a paper before the New York State Medical Association, before the American Psychiatric Association. I'll never forget that great annual meeting in Montreal. Maybe 9 out of 10 of the people in that room who heard my curbstone opinions as a stockbroker about alcoholism, and I added with trimmings that great illumination with the Roman candles and things, I don't believe 9 out of 10 took the slightest stock in what I was saying. This was so far from where they are. Their conditioning and mine had been so different. But they did one thing that we often fail to do. They tried hard to see what was in it. And they had seen recovery. And they asked themselves what this meant. And they accorded me something that we too often do not accord to them. They accorded to this society respect, an effort to understand, and even though they differed with us as to what happened, they knew that plenty was going on that was good, and that we could often do what they couldn't do. And in their humility, and we prayed about our own, they said, yes, publish this talk in our magazine. Take it out of there as a pamphlet and show it to worldwide to psychiatrists everywhere. This was one of the most moving examples of humility in the quarter where humility can come hard that I have ever seen. I once did some pieces called Let's Be Friendly with Our Friends. I guess most people agreed that this was a good idea, but some people said we have certain friends that we, I'll be goddamned if I want to be friendly with. But why not? Now, okay, we've got another class of thing. We've got some state efforts around rehabilitation things. We've got some private efforts. Some of them are good. Some of them are fairly good. Some of them are lousy, just like AA groups are. As a society, we are a decade older than they are, and they are in the trial and error process. And we attack these people when they use the AA name, when I think we should merely educate them, when we should educate the public that AA can't offer its endorsement, only its friendliness and cooperation where this is mutually profitable. There isn't any point of attacking people who pretty generally are dedicated. Sure, in these agencies, there are folks with an eye to the main chance, but have we no members in Alcoholics Anonymous who are not having an eye on the main chance? There was a time that we could have been fearful that these enterprises would be tempted to use our name for purposes of raising money, for purposes of getting publicity, for purposes of bringing off a sort of a matrimony between us and education and research and rehabilitation. There was a genuine cause, let us not say for fear, but for concern and apprehension, yes. And though in those days we were pretty small, But today, the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous is a thing of far greater power than any law. We know that its protection is something that we need. And these people are learning about it and learning to respect it. And the public is learning about it and learning to respect it. And those who, in carelessness, eagerness, willfulness, try to make a public use of it, well, they're finding that it's unprofitable. So we don't have to get sore or afraid of these people. We just say this is a part of the growing up process. And you must remember that these agencies are approached and will be approached in increasing numbers by alcoholics who are afraid of coming in here for fear they're going to get God-bitten or something. Therefore, our friendliness with those agencies, tempered only by our insistence that they don't use the AA name in public to further their interest, ought to be very freely and warmly given, because they are channels of communication to these uncounted millions that we haven't even got to, and can be increasingly so. And no matter how much politics or how much wasted money or how many swell jobs or how many vested interests are established, all of this is the history and grief of the evolution of something. Let us look at this with calmness and equanimity. Surely our strength among ourselves is so great that no one or any number of these agencies could possibly be the tail that wags the AA dog. Isn't that so? Now when the drunk gets himself sobered up in AA, or God gets him sober, he's a quick change artist. He's very resourceful. He gets a job and the community claps its hands and says, "My gosh, ain't this wonderful? What a wonderful job he's doing." Our behavior has forced them into a false position for which they are largely blameless and often unconscious. The relation between us as AA members is one of participation and cooperation, not of domination and dependence. This is partnership. So is marriage. Each with respect to the other. But under alcoholism, few marriages can avoid being damaged. The woman has to become the head of the house. She has to wear the pants. The man becomes dependent. And this gets to be a burnt-in thing over years and years and years of repetition. Now then, the repair of this close relationship, the one that means the most to us, is a slow business. And up to a few years ago, our idea of repair was to say to Mama, "Well, I'm going to take you down to a few open meetings. And down there you can warm our hands at that wonderful new fire we got. That is, if you will bake some cakes and pass the coffee. And Ma, you had better get a load of this stuff. And give me that checkbook. And I want this and that." So Ma comes down and she takes a look around. And she's awful grateful. But pretty soon, Pa or Sonny, as the case may be, has other playmates. Some of them female, too. And she becomes an A-A-Wutter. And she and Sonny are quite unconscious in most every case. It's a singularly blameless situation of the awful twist that mystifies them. They don't understand. Now, a good deal from our friends in psychiatry and out of our own experience, it finally looms up on us what the trouble is. And so there has grown up, not as a part of AA, but the nearest in part, a great society which grew faster in the last 10 years than we ever thought of growing in our first 10. And this society represents the effort of our partners in marriage to discover how they have been deformed and set about the repair of this deformity, as we had to set about the repair of our deformity. Sometimes we resent this a little. They're crashing our exclusive club. But if there's anything we should be friendly with, it's this. God knows it's in our interest. And at this time, just as you have allowed me to stand for you in some respects, so has Lois stood for Al-Anon. And let her chat about this a minute while I get my win.
Good evening, everybody. Here at this thrilling convention, AA's 25th anniversary, there are at least 3,000 of your grateful relatives, wives, husbands, mothers and fathers, daughters and sons. Many of us belong to the Al-Anon family groups that Bill was just telling you about. A fellowship based on the principles of AA for the relatives of problem drinkers generally, whether or not in AA. We have been banded together to better solve our common problems of fear, insecurity, lack of understanding of the alcoholic, and to help others with similar problems to straighten out their warped personal lives. In Al-Anon, we follow your lead. We admit that we are powerless over the problem of alcohol in our homes. We try to take our hands off your problems and to stop bossing, nagging, and managing your lives. We take our own inventory. Admit to God and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, and make amends to those we have harmed. We seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him. And we carry this message to others. In other words, we in Al-Anon are trying with the best of our ability to live by the very same precepts that have done so much for you. My own experience is a good example of how living by the AA and Al-Anon principles brought serenity and happiness where there had been frustration and self-pity. even after Bill stopped drinking. Bill started drinking a short time before we were married. And being alcoholic from the start, he got drunk every time he drank. Although I worried some about this, I was not deeply concerned because, like most young wives, I thought I could change him. And that our life together would be so happy and complete that he would not need an artificial stimulus. However, I didn't fix him. And his drinking got worse and worse. As we had no children, my life had but one purpose, helping Bill stop drinking. Finally, he too realized he must do something about it. And together we tried everything we could think of. Nothing worked. Our whole life simmered down to one terrific fight against alcohol. I had to assume all family responsibilities and look after him as a mother would care for a child. It is tragic indeed to watch such a fine man become so completely beaten and hopeless. A miracle happened, and Bill became a changed person almost overnight. We were awestruck by this amazing release, and our happiness and gratitude were unbounded. Bill worked endlessly and tirelessly, trying to sober up other alcoholics. Our house was full of all varieties of them, in all stages of sobriety. After a while, though, I began to realize that I wasn't as happy as I ought to be, considering the wonderful miracle that had happened, which I had been looking forward to for so long. I became irritable and touchy, losing my temper over trifles. I was deeply hurt that someone else had done for Bill in a few minutes what I had striven to accomplish our whole married life. I resented the fact that Bill and I had no life together anymore, that I was left alone while he was off somewhere scouting up new drunks or working with old ones. My life's job of sobering up Bill, with all its responsibilities, which made me feel so needed, had suddenly vanished, and I had not yet found anything to fill the void. Acting as domineering mother of a childlike alcoholic, and acting as real partner of a sober man, are two entirely different ways of life. It took me a long time to recognize the many adjustments that I must make in my thinking and emotional reactions. But when I did finally realize that a change was necessary in me, I decided to try to live by the same principles that had done so much for Bill, hoping they would do as much for me. By degrees, as we worked together on the program, our home life did become happier and more serene. There was understanding and give and take on any differences of opinion. All over the country, as AA grew, close relatives of members seemed to feel, as I did, the need for a program of self-understanding and development. It was this spontaneous recognition of need that resulted in the inception of our Al-Anon fellowship, and has been in large part responsible for its remarkable growth. In the 5 years since the St. Louis Convention, the number of Al-Anon groups has more than doubled. We had about 700 groups at that time. We now have over 1,400. Outside North America, in the 20 countries where Al-Anon has reached, there are 136 groups all told, four of them our teen groups. Of these 136 in U.S. territories, there is a group in Guam, two in Honolulu, and five in Puerto Rico. In Africa, both northern and southern Rhodesia have each a group, and there is one in Libya. But in Cape of Good Hope, we have 10 groups. In Natal, 3. And then in the Transvaal, 9. In Asia, there is a group in Japan and 2 in the Philippines. The 5 provinces of Australia have 56 Al-Anon groups. Australia and New Zealand, the latter with 14 groups, are 2 of the areas with our most rapidly growing Al-Anon populations. Al-Anon is in New Guinea, in Brussels, Belgium, and there is a proposed group in Denmark. Finland has 3 registered, but we understand there are several more. Germany has 5 groups and Holland 1. In Ireland there are 6, while North Ireland has 2, Scotland 1, and England 10. South of the border, there is a group in each of the following cities: Mexico City, Havana, San Jose, Costa Rica, Buenos Aires, and Caracas. Al-Anon is getting around. And it couldn't have done so, of course, without an efficient staff and enthusiastic volunteers at our Central Service Office in New York, where we have 5 paid workers and many willing volunteers. In 15 Al-Anon areas, intergroups or councils have developed for better information and communication with the area. The rise and growth of the Alateen movement has been one of our greatest thrills. Adolescent children of AAs and of alcoholics generally have banded together in fellowships similar to Al-Anon and with the same purpose. There are now 96 of these groups, and their potential benefit to the youth of the world is limitless. We of Al-Anon are proud to be having a part in this great convention, and we hope every AA that lives with an Al-Anon member finds that his home life is happier and more serene because of Al-Anon. We thank you for this golden opportunity to spread your message, which we have adopted as our own, to so many. Thank you.